Kutil and Melko arraigned before all the Vali, note 5, great and small, lying bound before the silver chair of Manwe. Against him speaketh Osse and Orome and Ulmo in deep ire, and Vana in abhorrence, proclaiming his deeds of cruelty and violence. Yet Makar still spake for him, although not warmly, for said he, "'Twere an ill thing if peace were for always. Already no blow echoes ever in the eternal quietude of Valinor. Wherefore, if one might neither see deed of battle, nor riotous joy even in the world without, then 'twould be irksome indeed, and I for one long not for such times." Thereat arose Palurian in sorrow and tears, and told of the plight of earth, and of the great beauty of her designs, and of those things she desired dearly to bring forth, of all the wealth of flower and herbage, of tree and fruit and grain that the world might bear if it had but peace. "Take heed, O Valar, that both elves and men be not devoid of all solace, when so the times come for them to find the earth." But Melko writhed in rage at the name of Eldar and of men, and at his own impotence. Now Aule mightily backed her in this, and after him many else of the gods, yet Mandos and Lorien held their peace, nor do they ever speak much at the councils of the Valar, or indeed at other times. But Tulkas arose angrily from the midst of the assembly, and went from among them, for he could not endure parleying where he thought the guilt to be clear. Liefer would he have unchained Melko, and fought him then and there alone upon the plain of Valinor, giving him many a sore buffet in meed of his ill-doings, rather than making high debate of them. Howbeit, Manwe sat and listened, and was moved by the speech of Palurian. Yet was it his thought that Melko was an Ainu and powerful beyond measure for the future good or evil of the world. Wherefore, he put away harshness, and his doom was this. For 3 ages, during the displeasure of the gods, should Melko be chained in a vault of Mandos by that chain Angino, and thereafter should he fare into the light of the 2 trees, but only so that he might for 4 ages yet dwell as a servant in the house of Tulkas, and obey him in requital of his ancient malice. Thus, said Manwe, and yet but hardly, mayst thou win favour again, sufficient that the gods suffer thee to abide thereafter in an house of thine own, and to have some slight estate among them, as befitteth a Vala and a lord of the Ainur. Such was the doom of Manwe, and even to Makar and Mease it seemed good, albeit Tulkas and Palurian thought it merciful to peril. Now doth Valinor enter upon its greatest time of peace, and all the earth beside, while Melko bideth in the deepest vaults of Mandos, and his heart grows black within him. Behold, the tumults of the sea abate slowly, and the fires beneath the mountains die. The earth quakes no more, and the fierceness of the cold and the stubbornness of the hills and rivers of ice is melted to the uttermost north and to the deepest south, even to the regions about Ringil and Helkar. Then Palurian goes once more out over the earth, and the forests multiply and spread, and often is Orome's horn heard behind her in the dimness. Now do nightshade and bryony begin to creep about the brakes, and holly and ilex are seen upon the earth. Even the faces of the cliffs are grown with ivies and trailing plants, for the calm of the winds and the quietude of the sea, and all the caverns and the shores are festooned with weeds, and great sea-growths come to life, swaying gently when Osse moves the waters. Now came that Vala and sat upon a headland of the great lands, having leisure in the stillness of his realm, and he saw how Palurian was filling the quiet dusk of the earth with flitting shapes. Bats and owls, whom Vefantur set free from Mandos, swooped about the sky, and nightingales sent by Lorien from Valinor trilled beside still waters. Far away a nightjar croaked, and in dark places snakes that slipped from Utumna when Melko was bound moved noiselessly about. A frog croaked upon a bear pool's border. Then he sent word to Ulmo of the new things that were done, and Ulmo desired not that the waters of the inner seas be longer unpeopled, but came forth seeking Palurian, and she gave him spells, and the seas began to gleam with fish or strange creatures crawled at bottom. Yet the shellfish and the oysters, no one of Valar or of Elves knows whence they are, for already they gaped in the silent waters, or ever Melko plunged therein from on high, and pearls there were before the Eldar thought or dreamed of any gem. Three great fish, luminous in the dark of the sunless days, went ever with Ulmo, and the roof of Ossi's dwelling beneath the great sea shone with phosphorescent scales. Behold, that was a time of great peace and quiet, and life struck deep roots into the new-made soils of earth, and seeds were sown that waited only for the light to come, and it is known and praised as the age of Melko's chains. Notes. 1. The following passage was added here apparently very soon after the writing of the text, but was later firmly struck through. The truth is that he is a son of Linwe Tinto, king of the Pipers, who was lost of old upon the great march from Palisor, and wandering in Hisilome, found the lonely twilight spirit Tindriel Wendelin dancing in a glade of beeches. Loving her, he was content to leave his folk and dance forever in the shadows, but his children, Timpinen and Tinuviel, long after joined the Eldar again, and tales there are concerning them both, though they are seldom told. The name Tindriel stood alone in the manuscript as written, but it was then bracketed and Wendelin added in the margin. These are the first references in the consecutive narrative to Thingol, Linwe Tinto, Hislum, Hisilome, Melian, Tindriel, Wendelin, and Luthien, Tinuviel. But I postpone discussion of these allusions. 2. Compare the explanation of the names Eriol and Angol as iron cliffs referred to in the appendix on names, entry Eriol. 3. Associated with the story of the sojourn of Eriol, Alfwine in Tol Eressia, and the lost tales that he heard there, are two schemes or synopses setting out the plan of the work. One of these is, for much of its length, a resume of the tales as they are extant. The other, certainly the later, is divergent. In this second scheme, in which the voyager is called Alfwine, the tale on the second night by the tale fire is given to Evromod, the door ward, though the narrative content was to be the same. The coming of the gods, the world fashioning and the building of Valinor, the planting of the two trees. After this is written, a later edition, Alfwine goes to beg Limpe of Meril. She sends him back. The third night by the tale fire is thus described. The door ward continues of the primeval twilight, the furies of Melko, Melko's chains and the awakening of the elves, how Fankil and many dark shapes escape into the world, given to Meril, but to be placed as here and much abridged. It seems certain that this was a revision in intention only, never achieved. It is notable that in the actual text, as also in the first of these two schemes, Rumil's function in the house is that of door ward, and Rumil, not Evromod, was the name that was preserved long after as the recounter of the music of the Ainur. 4. The text, as originally written, read, "But the great gods may not be slain, though their children may, and all those lesser people of the valley, albeit only at the hands of someone of the Valar." 5. Vali is an emendation from Valar. Compare Rumil's words, the music of the Ainur, side 2, they whom we now call the Valar, or Vali, it matters not. Commentary on the Chaining of Melko. In the interlude between this tale and the last, we encounter the figure of Timpinen, or Tinfang. This being had existed in my father's mind for some years, and there are two poems about him. The first is entitled Tinfang Wobble. It is very brief, but exists in three versions. According to a note by my father, the original was written at Oxford in 1914, and it was rewritten at Leeds in 1920-23. It was finally published in 1927 in a further altered form, which I give here. Footnote. Publication within a periodical referred to in the cutting preserved from it as IU Magazine. End of footnote. Tin Pan Wobble. Oh, the hoot, oh, the hoot, how he trillops on his flute, oh, the hoot of Tin Pan Wobble. Dancing all alone, hopping on a stone, flitting like a fawn in the twilight on the lawn, and his name is Tin Pan Wobble. The first star has shone, and its lamp is blown to a flame of flickering blue. He pipes not to me, he pipes not to thee, he whistles for none of you, his music is his own, the tunes of Tin Pan Wobble. In the earliest version, Tin Fang is called a lepron, and in the early glossary of the gnomish speech, he is a fae. The second poem is entitled Over Old Hills and Far Away. This exists in five texts, of which the earliest bears an Old English title as well, of the same meaning, Geon Fyrne Beorgas and Heonanfeor. Notes by my father state that it was written at Brockton Camp in Staffordshire between December 1915 and February 1916 and rewritten at Oxford in 1927. The final version given here differs in many details of wording and in places whole lines from earlier versions, from which I note at the end a few interesting readings. Over Old Hills and Far Away. It was early and still in the night of June, and few were the stars, and far was the moon. The drowsy trees drooping and silently creeping shadows woke under them while they were sleeping. I stole to the window with stealthy tread, leaving my white and unpressed bed, and something alluring, aloof and queer, like perfume of flowers, from the shores of the mere that in elven home lies, and in starlit rain twinkles and flashes, came up to the panes of my high lattice window, or was it a sound? I listened and marvelled with eyes on the ground, for there came from afar a filtered note, enchanting sweet, now clear, now remote, as clear as a star in a pool by the reeds, as faint as the glimmer of dew on the weed. Then I left the window and followed the call, down the creaking stairs and across the hall, out through a door that swung tall and grey, and over the lawn, and away, away. It was Tin Pan Wobble that was dancing there, fluting and tossing his old white hair, till it sparkled like frost in a winter moon, and the stars were about him and blinked to his tune, shimmering blue like sparks in a haze, as always they shimmer and shake when he plays. My feet only made there the ghost of a sound on the shining white pebbles that ringed him round, where his little feet flashed on a circle of sand, and the fingers were white on his flickering hand. In the wink of a star he had leapt in the air, with his fluttering cap and his glistening hair, and had cast his long flute right over his back, where it hung by a ribbon of silver and black. His slim little body went fine as a shade, and he slipped through the reeds like a mist in the glade, and he laughed like thin silver, and piped a thin note, as he flapped in the shadows his shadowy coat. Oh, the toes of his slippers were twisted and curled, but he danced like a wind out into the world. He is gone, and the valley is empty and bare, where lonely I stand, and lonely I stare. Then suddenly out in the meadows beyond, then back in the reeds by the shimmering pond, then afar from a copse where the mosses are thick, a few little notes came trilloping quick. I leapt o'er the stream, and I sped from the glade, for Tin Pan Wobble it was that played. I must follow the hoot of his twilight flute, over reed, over rush, under branch, over root, and over dim fields and through rustling grasses that murmur and nod as the old elf passes, over old hills and far away, where the harps of the elven folk softly play. Earlier readings. It was early and still in the night of June, and few were the stars, and far was the moon, was changed to, 'twas a very quiet evening once in June, and I thought that stars had grown bright too soon. Compare the prose text, the Nolderly say that the stars come out too soon if Tin Pan Wobble plays. Like perfume of flowers from the shores of the mere was changed to, like perfume of flowers by the fairies, Mia. That in Elvenhome lies and in starlit reigns. Elvenhome, emendation made on the text of the final version, replacing Fairyland. And the stars were about him and blinked to his tune was changed to Till the Stars Came Out as It Seemed Too Soon. Compare the note to line 2. Shimmering blue like sparks in a haze, as always they shimmer and shake when he plays, was changed to They always come out when he warbles and plays, and they shine bright blue as long as he stays. Compare the prose text, Or will he play beneath a goodly moon, and the stars go bright and blue? Where the harps of the elven folk softly play, elven folk, emendation made on the text of the final version, replacing fairies. The first part of this story of the chaining of Melko came to have a very different form in later versions, where the Silmarillion, page 35, it was during the sojourn of the Valar on the Isle of Almaren, under the light of the two lamps, that the seeds that Yavanna had sown began swiftly to sprout and to burgeon, and there arose a multitude of growing things, great and small, mosses and grasses and great ferns, and trees whose tops were crowned with cloud, and that beasts came forth and dwelt in the grassy plains, or in the rivers and the lakes, or walked in the shadows of the woods. This was the spring of Arda, but after the coming of Melkor and the delving of Utumno, green things fell sick and rotted, and rivers were choked with weeds and slime, and fens were made, rank and poisonous, the breeding place of flies, and forests grew dark and perilous, the haunts of fear, and beasts became monsters of horn and ivory, and dyed the earth with blood. Then came the fall of the lamps, and thus ended the spring of Arda, page 37. After the building of Valinor and the arising of the two trees, Middle-earth lay in a twilight beneath the stars, page 39, and Yavanna and Orome alone of the Valar returned there at times. Yavanna would walk there in the shadows, grieving because the growth and promise of the spring of Arda was stayed, and she set asleep upon many things that had arisen in the spring, so that they should not age, but should wait for a time of awakening that yet should be, page 47. But already the oldest living things had arisen, in the seas the great weeds, and on earth the shadow of great trees, and in the valleys of the night-clad hills there were dark creatures, old and strong. In this earliest narrative, on the other hand, there is no mention of the beginning of growth during the time when the lamps shone, see the coming of the Valar, side 3, and the first trees and low plants appeared under Yavanna's spells, in the twilight after their overthrow. Moreover, in the last sentence of this tale, seeds were sown in that time of quiet dusk, while Melko was chained, that waited only for the light to come. Thus, in the early story, Yavanna sows in the dark with a view, it seems, to growth and flowering in later days of sunlight, whereas in all the subsequent versions, the goddess, in the time of darkness, sows no more, but rather lays asleep on many things that had arisen beneath the light of the lamps in the spring of Arda. But both in the early tale and in the Silmarillion, there is a suggestion that Yavanna foresees that light will come in the end to the great lands, to Middle-earth. The conception of a flowing, liquid light in the airs of earth is again very marked, and it seems that in the original idea, the twilight ages of the world east of the sea were still illumined by the traces of this light. Seldom now falls the shimmering rain as it was used, and there reigns a gloom lit with pale streaks, as well as by the stars of Varda, even though the gods have gathered so much of that light that had before flowed about the airs. The renewed cosmic violence is conceivably the precursor of the great battle of the powers in the later mythology, the Silmarillion, page 51. But in this earliest tale, Melkor's upheavals are the cause of the Valar's visitation, whereas the Battle of the Powers, in which the shape of Middle-earth was changed, resulted from it. In the Silmarillion, it was the discovery of the newly awakened elves by Orome that led the Valar to the assault on Utumno. In its rich narrative detail, as in its primitive air, the tale told by Merrily Turinki of the capture of Melko bears little relation to the later narrative, while the tone of the encounter at Utumna and the treacherous shifts of the Valar to ensnare him is foreign to it likewise. But some elements survived. The chain Angainor, forged by Ale, if not the marvellous metal Tilkal, with its most uncharacteristically derived name, the wrestling of Tulkas with Melko, his imprisonment in Mandos for 3 ages, and the idea that his fortress was not destroyed to its foundations. It emerges, too, that the clement and trustful character of Manwë was early defined, while the reference to Mandos' seldom speaking is possibly a foreshadowing of his pronouncing his judgments only at the bidding of Manwë. The origin of nightingales in the domain of Lórien in Valinor is already present. Lastly, it may seem from the account of the journey of the Valar in this tale that his Ilome, which survived without any further change as the Quenya name of Hithlum, was here a quite distinct region from the later Hithlum, since it is placed beyond the Mountains of Iron. In the Silmarillion, the Mountains of Iron are said to have been reared by Melkor as a fence to his citadel of Utumno. They stood upon the borders of the regions of everlasting cold, in a great curve from east to west, page 118. But in fact, the Mountains of Iron here correspond to the later Mountains of Shadow, Ered Wethrin. In an annotated list of names accompanying the tale of the fall of Gondolin, the name Dor Lomin is thus defined. Dor Lomin, or the Land of Shadow, was that region named of the Eldar Hisilome, and this means shadowy twilights, and it is so called by reason of the scanty sun which peeps little over the Iron Mountains to the east and south of it. On the little map, the line of peaks which I have marked F almost certainly represents these mountains, and the region to the north of them, marked G, is then Hisilome. The manuscript continues from the point where I have ended the text in this chapter with no break, but this point is the end of a section in the mythological narrative, with a brief interruption by Eriol, and the remainder of Merrily Turinki's tale is reserved to the next chapter. Thus I make 2 tales of 1. 5. The Coming of the Elves and the Making of Kor. Introduction. I take this title from the cover of the book, which adds also how the elves did fashion gems, for as I have already remarked, the narrative continues without a new heading. The Coming of the Elves and the Making of Kor. Then said Eriol, "Sad was the unchaining of Melko, methinks. Even did it seem merciful and just. But how came the gods to do this thing?" Then Meryl, note 1, continuing, said, "Upon a time thereafter was the 3rd period of Melko's prisonment beneath the halls of Mandos come nearly to its ending. Manwë sat upon the top of the mountain, and gazed with his piercing eyes into the shades beyond Valinor, and hawks flew to him, and from him bearing many great tidings, but Varda was singing a song and looking upon the plain of Valinor. Silpion was at that time glimmering, and the roofs of Valmar below were black and silver beneath its rays, and Varda was joyous, but on a sudden Manwë spake, saying, 'Behold, there is a gleam of gold beneath the pine trees, and the deepest gloaming of the world is full of a patter of feet. The Eldar have come, O Taniquetil.' Then Varda arose swiftly and stretched her arms out north and south, and unbraided her long hair, and lifted up the song of the Valar, and Ilwë was filled with the loveliness of her voice. Then did she descend to Valmar and to the abode of Aule, and he was making vessels of silver for Lórien. A basin filled with the radiance of Telimpe, note 2, was by his side, and this he used cunningly in his craft. But now Varda stood before him and said, 'The Eldar have come,' and Aule flung down his hammer, saying, 'Then Ilúvatar hath sent them at last.' And the hammer, striking some ingots of silver upon the floor, did of its magic smite silver sparks to life, that flashed from his windows out into the heavens. Varda, seeing this, took of that radiance in the basin, and mingled it with molten silver to make it more stable, and fared upon her wings of speed, and set stars about the firmament in very great profusion, so that the skies grew marvellously fair, and their glory was doubled. And those stars that she then fastened have a power of slumbers, for the silver of their bodies came of the treasury of Lorien, and their radiance had lain in Telimpe long time in his garden. Some have said that the seven stars were set at that time by Varda to commemorate the coming of the Eldar, and that Morwinion, who blazes above the world's edge in the west, was dropped by her as she fared in great haste back to Valinor. Now this is indeed the true beginning of Morwinion and his beauty, yet the seven stars were not set by Varda, being indeed the sparks from Aule's forge, whose brightness in the ancient heavens urged Varda to make their rivals, yet this did she never achieve. But now, even as Varda is engaged in this great work, behold, Orome pricks over the plain, and drawing rein he shouts aloud so that all the ears in Valmar may hear him, "Tulielto, Tulielto, they have come, they have come." Then he stands midway between the two trees and winds his horn, and the gates of Valmar are opened, and the valley troop into the plain, for they guess that tidings of wonder have come into the world. Then spake Orome, "Behold, the woods of the great lands, even in Palisor, the midmost region, where the pine woods murmur unceasingly, are full of a strange noise. There did I wander, and lo, 'twas as if folk arose betimes beneath the latest stars. There was a stir among the distant trees, and words were spoken suddenly, and feet went to and fro. Then did I say, 'What is this deed that Palurian my mother has wrought in secret?' And I sought her out and questioned her, and she answered, 'This is no work of mine, but the hand of one far greater did this. Ilúvatar hath awakened his children at the last. Ride home to Valinor and tell the gods that the Eldar have come indeed.' Then shouted all the people of Valinor, 'Ye Eldar Tulier, the Eldar have come,' and it was not until that hour that the gods knew that their joy had contained a flaw, or that they had waited in hunger for its completion. But now they knew that the world had been an empty place, beset with loneliness, having no children for her own. Now once more is counsel set, and Manwë sitteth before the gods there amid the two trees, and those had now borne light for 4 ages. Every one of the valley fare thither, even Ulmo Vailimo in great haste from the outer seas, and his face is eager and glad. On that day Manwë released Melko from Angaino before the full time of his doom, but the manacles and the fetters of Tilkal were not unloosed, and he bore them yet upon wrist and ankle. Great joy blindeth even the 4 wisdom of the gods. Last of all came Palurian Yavanna, hasting from Palisor, and the Valar debated concerning the Eldar, but Melko sat at the feet of Tulkas, and feigned a glad and humble cheer. At length it is the word of the gods that some of the new-come Eldar be bidden to Valinor, there to speak to Manwë and his people, telling of their coming into the world, and of the desires that it awakened in them. Then does Nornore, whose feet flash invisibly for the greatness of their speed, hurtle from Valinor, bearing the embassy of Manwë, and he goes unstaying over both land and sea to Palisor. There he finds a place deep in a vale surrounded by pine-clad slopes. Its floor is a pool of wide water, and its roof the twilight set with Varda's stars. There had Orome heard the awaking of the Eldar, and all songs name that place Coivie Neni, or the Waters of Awakening. Now all the slopes of that valley and the bare margin of the lake, even the rugged fringes of the hills beyond, are filled with a concourse of folk who gaze in wonder at the stars, and some sing already with voices that are very beautiful. But Nornore stood upon a hill and was amazed for the beauty of that folk. And because he was a Valar, they seemed to him marvellously small and delicate, and their faces wistful and tender. Then did he speak in the great voice of the Valar, and all those shining faces turned towards his voice. "Behold, O Eldalie, desired are ye for all the age of twilight, and sought for throughout the ages of peace. And I come even from Manwe Sulimo, Lord of the Gods, who abides upon Taniquetil, in peace and wisdom, to you, who are the children of Iluvatar, and these are the words he put into my mouth to speak. Let now some few of you come back with me, for am I not Nornore, herald of the Valar, and enter Valinor and speak with him, that he may learn of your coming and of all your desires. Great was the stir and wonder now about the waters of Coivie, and its end was that three of the Eldar came forward, daring to go with Nornore, and these he bore now back to Valinor, and their names, as the elves of Kor have handed them on, were Isil Inwe, and Finwe Nolome, who was Turondo's father, and Tinwe Linto, father of Tinuviel, but the Noldali called them Inwithiel, Gorfinweg, and Tinwelent. Afterward, they became very great among the Eldar, and the Teleri were those who followed Isil, but his kindred and descendants are that royal folk, the Inwir, of whose blood I am. Nolome was the lord of the Noldali, and of his son Turondo, or Turgon, as they called him, are great tales told. But Tinwe, note 3, abode not long with his people, and yet, 'tis said, lives still lord of the scattered elves of Hisilome, dancing in its twilight places with Wendelin, his spouse, a sprite come long, long ago from the quiet gardens of Lorien. Yet greatest of all the elves did Isil Inwe become, and folk reverence his mighty name to this day. Behold, now brought by Nornore, the three elves stood before the gods, and it was at that time the changing of the lights, and Silpion was waning, but Laurelin was awakening to his greatest glory, even as Silmo emptied the urn of silver about the roots of the other tree. Then those elves were utterly dazed and astonished by the splendor of the light, whose eyes knew only the dusk, and had yet seen no brighter things than Varda's stars. But the beauty and majestic strength of the gods in conclave filled them with awe, and the roofs of Valmar blazing afar upon the plain made them tremble, and they bowed in reverence. But Manwe said to them, "Rise, O children of Iluvatar, for very glad are the gods of your coming. Tell us how ye came, how found ye the world, what seemeth it to you who are its first offspring, or with what desires doth it fill you?" But Nolome answering said, "Lo, most mighty one, whence indeed come we? For meseems I awoke but now from a sleep eternally profound, whose vast dreams already are forgotten." And Tinwe said thereto that his heart told him that he was new come from illimitable regions, yet he might not recollect by what dark and strange paths he had been brought. And last spake Inwe, who had been gazing upon Laurelin while the others spake, and he said, "Knowing neither whence I come, nor by what ways, nor yet whither I go, the world that we are in is but one great wonderment to me, and methinks I love it wholly, yet it fills me altogether with a desire for light." End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette. Side 5. The Book of Lost Tales, Part 1. Continuing with the coming of the elves and the making of Kor on page 116. Then Manwe saw that Iluvatar had wiped from the minds of the Eldar all knowledge of the manner of their coming, and that the gods might not discover it, and he was filled with deep astonishment. But Yavanna, who hearkened also, caught her breath for the stab of the words of Inwe, saying that he desired light. Then she looked upon Laurelin, and her heart thought of the fruitful orchards in Valmar. And she whispered to Tuivana, who sat beside her, gazing upon the tender grace of those Eldar. Then those twain said to Manwe, "Lo, the earth and its shadows are no place for creatures so fair, whom only the heart and mind of Iluvatar have conceived. Fair are the pine forests and the thickets, but they are full of unelfin spirits, and Mandos's children walk abroad, and vassals of Melko lurk in strange places, and we ourselves would not be without the sight of this sweet folk. Their distant laughter has filtered to our ears from Palasor, and we would have it echo always about us in our halls and pleasances in Valmar. Let the Eldar dwell among us, and the well of our joy be filled from new springs that may not dry up. Then arose a clamor among the gods, and the most spake for Palurian and Vanna, whereas Makar said that Valinor was builded for the Valar, and already is it a rose garden of fair ladies rather than an abode of men. Wherefore do ye desire to fill it with the children of the world? In this may I say back to him, and Mandos and Fui were cold to the Eldar as to all else. Yet was Varda vehement in support of Yavanna and Tuivanna, and indeed her love for the Eldar has ever been the greatest of all the folk of Valinor, and Aule and Lorien, Orome and Nessa and Ulmo most mightily proclaimed their desire for the bidding of the Eldar to dwell among the gods. Wherefore, albeit Ossi spake cautiously against it, belike out of that ever-smouldering jealousy and rebellion he felt against Ulmo, it was the voice of the council that the Eldar should be bidden, and the gods awaited but the judgment of Manwë. Behold, even Melko, seeing where was the majority, insinuated his guileful voice into the pleading, and has nonetheless since those days maligned the Valar, saying they did but summon the Eldar as to a prison out of covetous and jealousy of their beauty. Thus often did he lie to the Noldoli afterwards, when he would stir their restlessness, adding, beside all truth, that he alone had withstood the general voice, and spoken for the freedom of the elves. Maybe, indeed, had the gods decided otherwise, the world had been a fairer place now, and the Eldar a happier folk, but never would they have achieved such glory, knowledge, and beauty as they did of old, and still less would any of Melko's reeds have benefited them. Now, having hearkened to all that was said, Manwë gave judgment and was glad, for indeed his heart leaned of itself to the leading of the Eldar from the dusky world to the light of Valinor. Turning to the three Eldar, he said, "Go ye back now to your kindreds, and Nornore shall bring you swiftly there, even to Coivienneni in Palisor. Behold, this is the word of Manwë Sulemo, and the voice of the Valar's desire, that the people of the Eldalye, the children of Ilúvatar, fare to Valinor, and there dwell in the splendor of Laurelin and the radiance of Silpion, and know the happiness of the gods. An abode of surpassing beauty shall they possess, and the gods will aid them in its building." Thereto answered Inwë, "Fain are we indeed of thy bidding, and who of the Eldalye that have already longed for the beauty of the stars will stay or rest till his eyes have feasted on the blessed light of Valinor?" Thereafter, Nornore guided those elves back to the bare margins of Coivienneni, and standing upon a boulder, Inwë spake the embassy to all those hosts of the Eldalye that Ilúvatar waked first upon the earth, and all such as heard his words were filled with desire to see the faces of the gods. When Nornore, returning, told the Valar that the elves were indeed coming, and that Ilúvatar had set already a great multitude upon the earth, the gods made mighty preparation. Behold, Aule gathers his tools and stuffs, and Yavanna and Tuivanna wander about the plain, even to the foothills of the mountains and the bare coasts of the shadowy seas, seeking them a home and an abiding place. But Orome goeth straightway out of Valinor into the forests, whose every darkling glade he knew, and every dim path had traversed, for he purposed to guide the troops of the Eldar from Palisor over all the wide lands west, till they came to the confines of the great sea. To those dark shores fared Ulmo, and strange was the roaring of the unlit sea in those most ancient days upon that rocky coast, that bore still the scars of the tumultuous wrath of Melko. Falman Ossë was little pleased to see Ulmo in the great seas, for Ulmo had taken that island whereon Ossë himself had drawn the gods to Arvalin, saving them from the rising waters when Ringill and Helka thawed beneath their blazing lamps. That was many ages past in the days when the gods were new-come strangers in the world, and during all that time the island had floated darkly in the shadowy seas, desolate save when Ossë climbed its beaches on his journeys in the deeps. But now Ulmo had come upon his secret island, and harnessed thereto a host of the greatest fish, and amidmost was Uinn, the mightiest and most ancient of whales. And he bid these put forth their strength, and they drew the island mightily to the very shores of the great lands, even to the coast of Hisilome, northward of the Iron Mountains, whither all the deepest shades withdrew when the sun first arose. Now Ulmo stands there, and there comes a glint in the woods that marched even down to the sea foam in those quiet days, and behold, he hears the footsteps of the Teleri crackle in the forest, and Inwe is at their head beside the stirrup of Orome. Grievous had been their march, and dark and difficult the way through Hisilome, the land of shade, despite the skill and power of Orome. Indeed, long after the joy of Valinor had washed its memory faint, the elves sang still sadly of it, and told tales of many of their folk, whom they said and say were lost in those old forests, and ever wandered there in sorrow. Still were they there, long after, when men were shut in Hisilome by Melko, and still do they dance there, when men have wandered far over the lighter places of the earth. Hisilome did men name Ariador, and the lost elves did they call the Shadow Folk, and feared them. Nonetheless, the most of the great companies of the Teleri came now to the beaches, and climbed therefrom upon the island that Ulmo had brought. Ulmo counseled them that they wait not for the other kindreds, and though at first they will not yield, weeping at the thought, at last are they persuaded, and straightway are drawn with utmost speed beyond the shadowy seas and the wide bay of Arvalin to the strands of Valinor. There does the distant beauty of the trees, shining down the opening in the hills, enchant their hearts. And yet do they stand gazing back across the waters they have passed, for they know not where those other kindreds of their folk may be, and not even the loveliness of Valinor do they desire without them. Then, leaving them silent and wondering on the shore, Ulmo draws back that great island car to the rocks of Hisilome, and behold, warmed by the distant gleam of Lauralin that lit upon its western edge as it lay in the bay of Faerie, new and more tender trees begin to grow upon it, and the green of herbage is seen upon its slopes. Now Osse raises his head above the waves in wrath, deeming himself slighted that his aid was not sought in the ferrying of the elves, but his own island taken unasked. Fast does he follow in Ulmo's wake, and yet is left far behind, for Ulmo set the might of the Valar in Wynne and the Whale. Upon the cliffs there stand already the Noldoli in anguish, thinking themselves deserted in the gloom, and Noleme Finwë, who had led them thither hard upon the rear of the Teleri, went among them, enheartening them. Full of travail their journey too had been, for the world is wide, and nigh half across it had they come from most distant Palisor. And in those days neither sun shone nor moon gleamed, and pathways were there none, be it of elves or of men. Orome too was far ahead, riding before the Teleri upon the march, and was now gone back into the lands. There the Solosimpi were astray in the forests, stretching deep behind, and his horn wound faintly in the ears of those upon the shore, from whence that Vala sought them up and down the dark vales of Hisilome. Therefore, now coming, Ulmo thinks to draw the Noldoli swiftly to the strand of Valinor, returning once again for those others when Orome shall have led them to the coast. This does he, and Falman beholds that second ferrying from afar, and spumes in rage. But great is the joy of the Teleri and Noldoli upon that shore, where the lights are those of late summer afternoons, for the distant glow of Lindaloxi. There may I leave them for a while, and tell of the strange happenings that befell the Solosimpi by reason of Osse's wrath, and of the first dwelling upon Tol Eressëa. Fear falls upon them in that old darkness, and beguiled by the fair music of the Fae Wendelin, as other tales set forth more fully elsewhere, their leader, Tinwë Linto, was lost, and long they sought him, but it was in vain, and he came never again among them. Note 4. When, therefore, they heard the horn of Orome ringing in the forest, great was their joy, and gathering to its sound, soon are they led to the cliffs, and hear the murmur of the sunless sea. Long time they waited there, for Osse cast storms and shadows about the return of Ulmo, so that he drove by devious ways, and his great fish faltered in their going. Yet, at the last, do they too climb upon that island, and are drawn towards Valinor. And one Ellu they chose in place of Finwë, and he has ever since been named the Lord of the Solar Simpi. Note 5. Behold, now less than half the distance have they traversed, and the Twilight Isles float still far aloof, when Ossë and Onan waylay them in the western waters of the great sea, ere yet the mists of the shadowy seas are reached. Then Ossë seizes that island in his great hand, and all the great strength of wind may scarcely drag it onward, for at swimming, and in deeds of bodily strength in the water, none of the Valar, not even Ulmo's self, is Ossë's match. And indeed Ulmo was not at hand, for he was far ahead, piloting the great craft in the glooms that Ossë had gathered, leading it onward with the music of his conches. Now ere he can return, Ossë with Onan's aid had brought the isle to a stand, and was anchoring it even to the sea-bottom with giant ropes of those leather weeds and polyps that in those dark days had grown already in slow centuries to unimagined girth about the pillars of his deep-sea house. There too, as Ulmo urges the whales to put forth all their strength, and himself aids with all his godlike power, Ossë piles rocks and boulders of huge mass that Melko's ancient wrath had strewn about the sea floor, and builds these as a column beneath the island. Vainly doth Ulmo trumpet, and win with the flukes of his unmeasured tail lash the seas to wrath, for thither Ossë now brings every kind of deep-sea creature that buildeth itself a house and dwelling of stony shell, and these he planted about the base of the island. Corals there were of every kind, and barnacles and sponges like stone. Nonetheless, for a very great while did that struggle endure, until at length Ulmo returned to Valmar in wrath and dismay. There did he warn the other Valar that the Solar Simpi may not yet be brought thither, for that the isle has grown fast in the most lonely waters of the world. There stands that island yet. Indeed, thou knowest it, for it is called the Lonely Isle, and no land may be seen for many leagues' sail from its cliffs, for the Twilight Isles upon the bosom of the shadowy seas are deep in the dim west, and the Magic Isles lie backward in the east. Now therefore do the gods bid the elves build a dwelling, and Aule aided them in that, but Ulmo fares back to the lonely island, and lo, it stands now upon a pillar of rock upon the sea's floor, and Ossë fares about it in a foam of business, anchoring all the scattered islands of his domain fast to the ocean bed. Hence came the first dwelling of the Solar Simpi on the lonely island, and the deeper sundering of that folk from the others, both in speech and customs. For know that all these great deeds of the past that make but a small tale now were not likely achieved, and in a moment of time, but rather would very many men have grown and died betwixt the binding of the islands and the making of the ships. Twice now had that isle of their dwelling caught the gleam of the glorious trees of Valinor, and so was it already fairer and more fertile and more full of sweet plants and grasses than the other places of all the world beside, where great light had not been seen. Indeed, the Solar Simpi say that birches grew there already, and many reeds, and turf there was upon the western slopes. There, too, were many caverns, and there was a stretching shoreland of white sand about the feet of black and purple cliffs, and here was the dwelling even in the deepest days of the Solar Simpi. There Ulmo sat upon a headland, and spake to them words of comfort, and of the deepest wisdom, and all sea lore he told them, and they hearkened, and music he taught them, and they made slender pipes of shells. By reason of that labor of Ossë, there are no strands so strewn with marvelous shells as were the white beaches and the sheltered coves of Tolaresia, and the Solar Simpi dwelt much in caves, and adorned them with those sea treasures, and the sound of their wistful piping might be heard for many a long day come faintly down the winds. Then Falman Ossë's heart melted towards them, and he would have released them, save for the new joy and pride he had, that their beauty dwelt thus amidmost of his realm, so that their pipes gave perpetual pleasure to his ear, and Winan, note 6, and the Oarni, and all the spirits of the waves were enamoured of them. So danced the Solosimpi upon the wave's brink, and the love of the sea and rocky coasts entered in their hearts, even though they gazed in longing towards the happy shores whither long ago the Teleri and Noldali had been born. Now these, after a season, took hope, and their sorrow grew less bitter, learning how their kindred dwelt in no unkindly land, and Ulmo had them under his care and guardianship. Wherefore they heeded now the god's desire, and turned to the building of their home. And Aule taught them very much lore and skill, and Manwe also. Now Manwe loved more the Teleri, and from him and from Omar did they learn deeper of the craft of song and poesy than all the elves beside. But the Noldali were beloved most by Aule, and they learned much of his science, till their hearts became unquiet for the lust of more knowing. But they grew to great wisdom and to great subtlety of skill. Behold, there is a low place in that ring of mountains that guards Valinor, and there the shining of the trees steals through from the plain beyond and gilds the dark waters of the bay of Arvalin, note 7. But a great beach of finest sand, golden in the blaze of Lauralin, white in the light of Silphion, runs inland there, where in the trouble of the ancient seas a shadowy arm of water had groped in toward Valinor, but now there is only a slender water fringed with white. At the head of this long creek there stands a lonely hill which gazes at the loftier mountains. Now all the walls of that inlet of the seas are luxuriant with a marvellous vigour of fair trees, but the hill is covered only with a deep turf, and harebells grow atop of it, ringing softly in the gentle breath of Sulimo. Here was the place that those fair elves bethought them to dwell, and the gods named that hill Kor, by reason of its roundness and its smoothness. Thither did Aule bring all the dust of magic metals that his great works had made and gathered, and he piled it about the foot of that hill. And most of this dust was of gold, and a sand of gold stretched away from the feet of Kor out into the distance, where the two trees blossomed. Upon the hilltop the elves built fair abodes of shining white, of marbles and stones quarried from the mountains of Valinor, that glistened wondrously, note 8, silver and gold, and a substance of great hardness and white lucency, that they contrived of shells melted in the dew of Silphion. And white streets there were, bordered with dark trees, that wound with graceful turns, or climbed with flights of delicate stairs, up from the plain of Valinor to topmost Kor. And all those shining houses clomb each shoulder higher than the others till the house of Inwe was reached, that was the uppermost, and had a slender silver tower shooting skyward like a needle, and a white lamp of piercing ray was set therein that shone upon the shadows of the bay, but every window of the city on the hill of Kor looked out toward the sea. Fountains there were of great beauty and frailty, and roofs and pinnacles of bright glass and amber that was made by Palurian and Ulmo, and trees stood thick on the white walls and terraces, and their golden fruit shone richly. Now at the building of Kor the gods gave to Inwe and to Nolome a shoot each of either of those glorious trees, and they grew to very small and slender elfin trees, but blossomed both eternally without abating, and those of the courts of Inwe were the fairest. And about them the Teleri sang songs of happiness, but others, singing also, fared up and down the marble flights, and the wistful voices of the Noldali were heard about the courts and chambers. But yet the Solosimpi dwelt far off amid the sea, and made windy music on their pipes of shell. Now is Asse very fain of those Solosimpi, the shoreland pipers, and if Ulmo be not nigh, he sits upon a reef at sea, and many of the Oani are by him, and hearkens to their voice, and watches their flitting dances on this shore. But to Valmar he dare not fare again, for the power of Ulmo in the councils of the Valar, and the wrath of that mighty one at the anchoring of the islands. Indeed, war had been but held off by the gods, who desired peace, and would not suffer Ulmo to gather the folk of the Valar, and assail Asse and rend the islands from their new roots. Therefore does Asse sometimes ride the foams out into the bay of Arvalin, note 9, and gaze upon the glory on the hills, and he longs for the light and happiness upon the plain, but most for the song of birds and the swift movement of their wings into the clear air, grown weary of his silver and dark fish, silent and strange amid the deep waters. But on a day some birds came flying high from the gardens of Yavanna, and some were white and some black, and some both black and white. And being dazed among the shadows, they had not where to settle, and Ose coaxed them, and they settled about his mighty shoulders. And he taught them to swim, and gave them great strength of wing, for of such strength of shoulder he had more than any other being, and was the greatest of swimmers. And he poured fishy oils upon their feathers, that they might bear the waters, and he fed them on small fish. Then did he turn away to his own seas, and they swam about him, or fared above him on low wing, crying and piping. And he showed them dwellings on the twilit isles, and even about the cliffs of Tolaresia, and the manner of diving and of spearing fish they learned there, and their voices became harsh, for the rugged places of their life, far from the soft regions of Valinor, or wailing for the music of the Solosimpi and sighing of the sea. And now have all that great folk of gulls and sea-mews and petrels come into their kingdom, and puffins are there, and eider-duck, and cormorants, and gannets, and rock-doves, and the cliffs are full of a chattering and a smell of fish, and great conclaves are held upon their ledges, or among spits and reefs among the waters. But the proudest of all these birds were the swans, and these Ose let dwell in Tolaresia, flying along its coasts, or paddling inland up its streams, and he set them there as a gift and joy to the Solosimpi. But when Ulmo heard of these new deeds, he was ill-pleased for the havoc wrought amid the fishes, wherewith he had filled the waters with the aid of Palurian. Now do the Solosimpi take great joy of their birds, new creatures to them, and of swans, and behold upon the lakes of Tolaresia, already they fare on rafts of fallen timber, and some harness thereto swans, and speed across the waters. But the more hardy dare out upon the sea, and the gulls draw them. And when Ulmo saw that, he was very glad. For lo, the Teleri and Noldoli complain much to Manwe of the separation of the Solosimpi, and the gods desire them to be drawn to Valinor. But Ulmo cannot yet think of any device, save by help of Ose and the Owarni, and will not be humbled to this. But now does he fare home in haste to Aule, and those twain got them speedily to Tolaresia, and Orome was with them, and there is the first hewing of trees that was done in the world outside Valinor. Now does Aule of the thorn wood of pine and oak make great vessels, like to the bodies of swans, and these he covers with the bark of silver birches, or with gathered feathers of the oily plumage of Ose's birds, and they are nailed and sturdily riveted and fastened with silver, and he carves prows for them, like the upheld necks of swans, but they are hollow and have no feet, and by cords of great strength and slimness are gulls and petrels harnessed to them, for they were tamed to the hands of the Solosimpi, because their hearts were so turned by Ose. Now are the beaches upon the western shores of Tolaresia, even at Falase Numea, western surf, thronged with that people of the elves, and drawn up there is a very great host indeed of those swan ships, and the cry of the gulls above them is unceasing. But the Solosimpi arise in great numbers, and climb into the hollow bodies of these new things of Aule's skill, and more of their kin fare ever to the shores, marching to the sound of innumerable pipes and flutes. Now all are embarked, and the gulls fare mightily into the twilight sky, but Aule and Orome are in the foremost galley and the mightiest, and 700 gulls are harnessed thereto, and it gleams with silver and white feathers, and has a beak of gold, and eyes of jet and amber. But Ulmo fares at the rear in his fishy car, and trumpets loudly for the discomfiture of Ose, and the rescue of the shoreland elves. But Ose, seeing how these birds have been to his undoing, is very downcast. Yet for the presence of those three gods, and indeed for his love of the Solosimpi that had grown by now very great, he molested not their white fleet, And they came thus over the grey leagues of the ocean, through the dim sounds and the mists of the shadowy seas, even to the first dark waters of the bay of Arvalin. Know then that the lonely island is upon the confines of the great sea. Now that great sea, or the western water, is beyond the westernmost limits of the great lands, and in it are many lands and islands, ere beyond their anchorage you reach the magic isles, and beyond these still lies Tolaresia. But beyond Tolaresia is the misty wall, and those great sea glooms beneath which lie the shadowy seas, and thereon float the twilight isles, whither only pierced at clearest times the faintest twinkle of the far gleam of Silpion. But in the westernmost of these stood the Tower of Pearl, built in after days, and much sung in song. But the twilight isles are held the first of the outer lands, which are these, and Arvalin and Valinor, and Tolaresia is held neither of the outer lands or of the great lands, where men after roamed. But the farthest shore of those shadowy seas is Arvalin, or Erumani to the far south, but more northerly do they lap the very coasts of Eldamar, and here are they broader to one faring west. Beyond Arvalin tower those huge mountains of Valinor, which are in a great ring bending slowly west, but the shadowy seas make a vast bay to the north of Arvalin, running right up to the black feet of the mountains, so that here they border upon the waters and not upon the lands, and there at the bay's innermost stands Taniquetil, glorious to behold, loftiest of all mountains, clad in purest snow, looking across Arvalin, half south and half north, across that mighty bay of Faerie, and so beyond the shadowy seas themselves, even so that all the sails upon the sunlit waters of the great sea in after days, when the gods had made that lamp, and all the throngs about the western havens of the lands of men, could be seen from its summit. And yet is that distance counted only in unimagined leagues. But now comes that strange fleet nigh these regions, and eager eyes look out. There stands Taniquetil, and he is purple and dark of one side, with gloom of Arvalin and of the shadowy seas, and lit in glory of the other by reason of the light of the trees of Valinor. Now where the seas lapped those shores of old, their waves long ere their breaking were suddenly lit by Laurelin, were it day, or by Silpion, were it night, and the shadows of the world ceased almost abruptly, and the waves laughed. But an opening in the mountains on those shores let through a glimpse of Valinor, and there stood the hill of Kor, and the white sand runs up the creek to meet it, but its feet are in green water, and behind the sand of gold fares away farther than I can guess, and indeed beyond Valinor, who has heard or seen anything save Ulmo, yet of a certainty he has spread the dark waters of the outer seas. Tideless are they, and very cool, and so thin that no boat can float upon their bosom, and few fish swim beneath their depths. But now upon the hill of Kor is a running and a joyous concourse, and all the people of the Teleri and Nolloli fare out of the gates, and wait to welcome the coming of the fleet upon the shore. And now those ships leave the shadows, and now are caught in the bright gleam about the inner bay, and now are they beached high, and the Solosimpi dance and pipe, and mingle with the singing of the Teleri and the Nolloli's faint music. Far behind lay Tolaresia in silence, and its woods and shores were still, for nearly all that host of seabirds had flown after the Eldar, and wailed now about the shores of Eldamar. But Osse dwelt in despondency, and his